Welcome back to season two of Blazing Trails. I'm Sabrina Barakzai, social and content marketer for Salesforce Strategic Events. We're sharing stories that reach beyond the tech industry. So no matter your career, location, or interests, we aim to curate a podcast that speaks to you. Today, we are talking about motivation. The stories that we tell ourselves are how we find personal motivation. Last year at Dreamforce, we heard stories from hundreds of speakers who shared their triumphs, struggles, and inspired all of us. During many of our Dream Talks, our short 25-minute inspiring talks, the topic of motivation arose. What motivates us to change our narratives? What motivates us to keep going? It's been said that we all have at least one doppelganger. How would you feel if yours couldn't be any more different than you? This is a story in black and white. One Michael Tubbs is African-American, and the other, white. One represents American aspirationalism, the other, American abhorrence and intolerance. One is an inspirational tale of hope and the richness of the American melting pot, and the other reeks of hate and racism. Every now and then, Michael Tubbs, the 27-year-old mayor of Stockton, California, comes across news of the other Michael Tubbs, and he cringes. They have the same name, but a completely opposite aim in life. In this Dream Talk, hear how Mayor Tubbs deals with his doppelganger. We also discover how he is motivated to work hard to improve the lives and outcomes of those who live in his very diverse city, in the spirit of equality and justice, regardless of race or class. Let's listen in.
Good afternoon. I'm really excited to be with you all here today because today's my 1 year anniversary of being Mayor of Stockton. So as mayor of the city of Stockton, I thought I had ownership of my name. I thought surely the only other Michael Tubbs out there would be my father. But on August 11th, I was in for a rude awakening. I was on Twitter, and I was getting all these mentions about how Michael Tubbs was in Charlottesville, Virginia, protesting in support of white supremacy. And I said, well, look at me. I'm not some Dave Chappelle skit. How is that possible? And then I discovered that there was another Michael Tubbs. He's very passionate like I am. I've never met the guy, but I read. He's very passionate like I am. He has a big sense of what's right and what's wrong with his country. He's interested in establishing some sort of white supremacist state. And actually, 27 years ago, the year I was born, he was arrested for trying to bomb black and Jewish businesses. Now, I want to start with the other Michael Tubbs. I want to start with them because I think, as we've seen in the past year, it's a vestige of the past in terms of some of the thinking, but it's also very, very current, and also a challenge collectively we have to solve. I think growing up in Stockton, California, a lot of those attitudes really motivated me. I was born, my mom, she had me when she was a teenager. My father's been incarcerated my entire life. And growing up, I had a huge chip on my shoulder to prove that, number one, poor people weren't lazy. That oftentimes people weren't poor because of some moral failings or because they didn't care or they didn't try or they lacked grit or resiliency. And also as a young black man, I felt the burden of proving that I wasn't inherently criminal, I wasn't inherently dangerous, I wasn't inherently bad. And being from Stockton, California, a city of 315,000 people, 80 miles away, but in many respects a world away. A community like many other communities with great assets, great people, great diversity, but a real issue. So I thought in seventh grade when I read this poem by Tupac Shakur about this rose that grew from concrete, that that was what I was going to be. And the poem goes like this. It goes, have you heard of the rose that grew from the crack in the concrete, proving nature's laws wrong and learn to walk without having feet? Funny it seems, but by keeping its dreams, and learn to breathe fresh air. Long live the rose that grew from the crack in the concrete when no one else cared. So growing up, that was my impetus. That was my focus. I thought if I work hard enough, if I study enough, if I pull myself up by my bootstraps, if I do everything right, then I will avail myself to every opportunity present in this country. And also because of that attitude growing up, I had a sense of almost condescension towards other people from similar communities with similar family structures who maybe didn't, quote unquote, work as hard as me or do as much as me. And I took that attitude with me to Stanford University. As I left Stockton as a 17-year-old, I left thinking I would never come back. I left thinking that I had proved that meritocracy is correct, That all you have to do is work hard and work hard, and even if you have to work 3 or 4 times as hard as other people, if you work hard, that's all that's necessary for you to be a success. And again, I think a lot of that was motivated by my dad being incarcerated. A lot of that was motivated by my mom having me in high school and being on welfare for the first 5 years of my life. But I thought I figured it out, that the attitude that the other Michael Tubbs has is false, and it's false because if I work hard, I can prove them wrong. But then in Halloween 2010, I was in for another rude awakening. At this point, I was interning in the former administration's White House as an intern in intergovernmental affairs, and my job was to work with mayors and councils nationwide. I didn't really enjoy the job, but I was in the White House, and that's like a big deal, so I was really happy and proud of myself. But on Halloween 2010, the next day, I came to work, and my mom called me. She called, and my mom's not the most emotional person, so when she called crying, I knew something was up. And she told me that one of my first cousins was murdered back home at a house party. And for me, that was a real kind of awakening. It was a real kind of come to Jesus moment. And it was, okay, well, you left Stockton, you worked hard, you got out. What if you went back and just showed people, if you work hard enough, things aren't fair, but everything will be all right. If you make all the right choices and you do everything correct and, you know, go to house parties, like that, you'll be fine. And I was really motivated by my Judeo-Christian upbringing and around this story of the Good Samaritan. And you guys know the story, but I'll tell it briefly. Apparently, 1,000 years ago, at least what Jesus said, there was some guy walking down the road, the Jericho Road, and he was walking, got beat up, left on the side of the road, essentially to die. And then the story goes, a Levite, like a priest, saw the man on the side of the road, probably thought, well, hey, maybe he chose to be on the side of the road, like he did something bad, and this is God's punishment for him to be left on the side of the road. Or maybe he was late for church or something, so he left. And then, I'm going to do a 2017 version, so then maybe a young politician from Stockton came by and saw the man on the side of the road and said, well, you know, late for a meeting, again, maybe this man made choices. If he had rode his horse hard enough and maybe whipped the horse a little bit faster, he could have outran the robbers, and maybe then he would not be on the side of the road. And then finally, a good Samaritan saw the man side of the road. He decided to get off his high horse, got down on the ground with him, gave him Band-Aids, gave him aspirin. Then not only that, sent him to the Regent Hotel, paid for it, made sure he was good, and then went on his way. And I thought that was then the policy solution. It was like, well, hey, Michael, you've been blessed, you've been successful, maybe to prove these attitudes around white supremacy and the inherent failings of poor people, that maybe I just need to be like a good Samaritan and just get dirty and get down and help individuals as I can and show them that by their own hard work, they can do that. So that's what motivated me to run for city council. In 2012, I ran with this good Samaritan impulse, and then a crazy thing happened. I got elected. So in 2013, I was elected, and I realized that all the nonprofits, all the programs, all the things that we were involved in or doing were important, but they were necessary but not sufficient. Because I don't know if any of you guys have been to the Jericho Road, but Dr. King tells it beautifully. He says, well, the road, in many respects, is structured for violence. It's 200 feet below sea level. It's conducive for ambushing. So at the time, the Good Samaritan helped the one guy get off the side of the road. By the time he got back, there's probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people left on the side of the road because although the Good Samaritan did a good deed, the structure of the road was unchanged. And that was an aha moment for me as a council member because I realized we were running mentorship programs and everything was like program, and we were helping some people. But in terms of the scale we were interested in, we weren't getting it. And I submit to you today that a lot of it is from what I wish he was my friend. He's my friend because I read his books. Dr. Paul Farmer calls structural violence. He says oftentimes we talk about every community and we talk about people who are victims of violence or things, the outcomes aren't similar to other communities. He says oftentimes the blame is put, again, on the individual, on the person. But he challenged us to think about how structures can be violent or how our society, in many respects, is structured for people not to reach their full potential. And he defines structural violence as the avoidable impairment of basic human needs. Basic human needs like access to preschool. Or basic human needs like access to a grocery store instead of liquor stores. Basic human needs like not going to sleep hearing gunshots. Basic human needs like going to a good school, probably like the schools we want all our kids to go to. And he talks about that's the reason why that leads to a lot of these inequities we see in society. So again, 22 years old, in city council, doing all these readings and noticing like, wow, we could do all this programmatic stuff, but until we get serious about fighting structural violence, then our work will really be in vain. So today I want to submit to you sort of the frame we're using to reinvent Stockton. And not saying we have all the answers, we definitely have issues, but this is how we're thinking in terms of what it will take to really transform our community to ensure that Michael Tubbs is not a singular story, well, this Michael Tubbs, that this Michael Tubbs is not a singular story, but the story of all the wonderful children that call our community home. So the first thing around sort of fighting structural violence is this idea of equality versus equity. And it's a little bit ironic because I understand I'm speaking at an equality summit, which is great, but equity demands a little bit more, and I think the picture shows it all. That you see, everyone, when everyone's equal, it's not the outcomes aren't necessarily as equal as they can be because people are starting at different starting points. But when things are equitable, then everyone gets what they need to reach their potential. And especially when we think about marginalized community, marginalized groups, marginalized people, that's what's required. It's not enough to treat everyone equally when everyone's starting at vastly different starting points. The second frame we're using in terms of how we're organizing ourselves in Stockton is this idea of charity versus justice. And again, I think the Good Samaritan parable is a good kind of synopsis of that, but essentially it's this. I define charity as necessary but not sufficient for the outcomes I want to see in terms of Stockton being a safe community, a thriving community, a destination community where people want to live and grow their kids. And the difference is not somatic, but it's this. Charity is I really define charity as like what I can do as an individual and justice around sort of what we can do collectively. I think charity takes the assumption that I have something to give you, whether it's a donation, whether it's a check, whether it's an hour of my time, all those things are important. But I think justice isn't saying I don't need to inspire you, but I need to empower you. I don't need to give you anything but the tools to be active architects of the community, world, and society that you want to see. And I think oftentimes we spend so much of our energy on charity and we don't really focus on justice because justice requires conflict sometimes. Justice isn't nice. Like, people have died in this country for justice. Like, blood has been shed for justice. And it requires oftentimes a level of sacrifice that charity doesn't. And then kind of the last pillar of the work we're endeavoring to do in Stockton is this idea of listening. So if I was a good Samaritan, I would have spent a little bit of time, instead of just going immediately to help the man on the side of the road, to listen and understand what happened that led him to get to the side of the road so that it wouldn't happen again. I think oftentimes, especially those of us with resources and means and access, we rush so quickly to the solution phase, but there's a lot of deep learning that happens when we listen and understanding that those closest to the problem, closest to the pain, closest to the issues, have answers. I tell people all the time that I truly believe that talent and intelligence are universal. I don't think this room, I don't think the institution I went to, Stanford, has a monopoly on talent or intelligence at all. I think those things are universal, but oftentimes resources and opportunities are not. So if those of us who really value equality and equity, I think the challenge is how do we organize and orient ourselves to provide resources and opportunities to folks so we're not speaking for them, that we're not giving them, but they're at the table articulating solutions for themselves. So using that frame, we've been focused on investment and not incarceration. Because oftentimes in communities, the response to every issue, whether it's poverty, whether it's crime, whether it's mental health, whatever it is, our first response is more cops, more cops, more cops. So for the past 11 months as a mayor, we've been focused on, number one, the five areas in our community that have some of our highest crime rates, but changing the orientation so it's not that these communities need more cops, which may or may not be true, but the community doesn't just suffer from crime. It suffers from these particular neighborhoods, suffer from poverty, from bad schools, from lack of access to health facilities, from basically everything bad they have in abundance, and everything good is lacking. So we're focusing on, okay, what investments in addition to law enforcement can we make in these communities? And we piloted this in my council district, and we haven't solved all the issues, but we're seeing promising signs of success. And the most promising side is that those who actually live in the neighborhood, who have to be there every single day, are actively part of the solution. So we're able to close down problem liquor stores, we're able to open health clinics, we're able to bring the first bank in that area in 50 years, all from valuing justice over charity, from listening, and from really being focused about how do we invest in this community, understand that the issue isn't just a law enforcement issue, it's a deeper structural societal issue of structural violence that necessitates a collective impact response.
Want to experience the magic of Dreamforce but don't have a full conference pass? We are thrilled to invite you to register for a free Expo Plus pass for access to select events on Thursday and Friday at Dreamforce. Head over to dreamforce.com/free to register now. With the free pass, you'll learn about the latest innovations at select product and industry keynotes, test drive thousands of solutions, access hundreds of partners in the Customer Success Expo, and network with fellow trailblazers. Again, register at dreamforce.com/free, and we'll see you in September. Army Major Lisa Jaster is a soldier, an engineer, a wife and mother, and a trailblazer. One of only three women to graduate from the first integrated United States Army Ranger program, one of the most difficult combat training courses in the world, Lisa was the first female Army Reserve officer to become a Ranger. She completed the training, which 36% of male and female students fail within the first 4 days, after refusing to succumb to exhaustion and repeatedly recycling through or retrying several phases of the multi-locational course. Lisa endured the training, which takes a minimum of 61 days and includes up to 20 hours of training per day alongside a strict diet for 6 grueling months. She graduated at age 37, while the average trainee age is 23. What motivated her? What drove her to never quit? Let's find out.
So no shit, there I was.
Army Ranger School.
Very exciting, right? There's the first phase, it's the walk phase. As you go into the field, you start by jumping out of an airplane. Let me explain something to you. I jumped out of an airplane for the first time in 1998. I did it again in 1999. And then I did it again at 37 in 2015. So there was a slight gap between the last time I threw myself from a perfectly good moving aircraft until Ranger School. So I go out the door the first time I'm starting Ranger School. I'm excited. We're going into the field. I'm doing something that no female has ever done, jumping into a Ranger training area. The second time I threw myself out of the airplane because I had to repeat the first phase, I'm like, okay, I'm good. Feet and knees together, checking my risers. This is easy, old hat, very exciting. I used to say when I was younger, because we're all stupid when we're younger, I hope I die jumping out of a plane because it's gorgeous, and then splat. And these are the things that went through my 20-something year old mind. At 37, when I have to repeat the first phase for the third time in a row, get out of the airplane, check canopy gain, canopy control, making sure my chute's good, look out at that gorgeous horizon, and I start to sob. What am I doing here? I'm 37 years old. The average Ranger School graduate is 22. And male. All of them. So Chris Shea and I are jumping in, and we're the only females to be doing this. Why the hell am I here? But I hit the ground like a sack of potatoes. As always, I landed feet, butt, head. Shook it off, saw all the guys running off, grabbed my gear, and started out. I was gonna start again on this adventure. I wasn't gonna quit, and I wasn't gonna get defeated. But again, why? Why would I want to go to Ranger School? This is a really busy slide. This is for those of you who don't have the pleasure of knowing what that school's about. Yes, the average age is 22. You sleep an average of 3.5 to 4.5 hours. Remember, that's an average, so a lot of times it's less. Once in a while, they have to give you more. This is just a picture of what that school is. But why would I want to go? How many here are parents? Daughters? Sons? Okay. So here's a conversation I had with one of my very good friends. We went to basic training together in 1996. When I told him that I was interested in going to Ranger School, the first thing he said to me is, "We have to protect our women." Okay, what does that mean? Remember, he's my buddy. He's like, I don't really believe that women need to be in the military. And we need to protect our women. I said, Clint, you gotta tell me. Now the dude's name's Clint, so, okay. But Clint's talking to me and he's like, if I had a son and he got a flat tire on the side of the road and he called me, I'd be like, suck it up, buttercup, change your tire, get home when you can, right? We all believe that's probably something you would say to a young kid. All right, well, if my daughter had the same flat tire in the same location, I would tell her to lock the doors and keep her cell phone on, and I'll be right there. So I, of course, am in utter shock. I'm like, Clint, so you're gonna raise a victim? And he's like, no, I'm protecting my daughter. I said, protecting her. And then this is how I brought him over to the dark side. I said, so, rather than your daughter being competent and capable of changing her tire and getting back on the road and getting home safe, you're gonna have her sit on the side of the road, waiting for some stranger to come help her? No, I'll be right there. Oh yeah? I know that when I'm driving with my dad or my husband or my brother or by myself and I see somebody stranded on the side of the road, especially if they've got a flat tire and it looks like they've got no clue what they're supposed to do, I pull over. So not only are you building a victim, but you're exposing your daughter to dangers that she otherwise wouldn't be exposed to. So when I wrapped it up like that, he's like, okay, yeah, but why should you go to Ranger School? I said, it's the same thing. I'm still going across the pond. I'm still gonna be leading soldiers. Don't you think you want me being as competent and capable as possible? Let's stop making it a gender issue. Let's stop talking about my strength or the mystical bro bond of integrating men and women in a combat zone. Let's just talk about a training event. If you're gonna train men to be awesome, shouldn't you train women to be awesome too? Just a little question I had for him. I have to keep this over here, otherwise I'll probably throw it across the stage, so I'm sorry. So I got to learn a lot while I was at that school. Everybody asks how much you learn about yourself. When you go to a leadership school where they don't feed you and you don't eat, you don't sleep a whole lot, everybody comes back and they tell about what they learned about themselves. At 37, I had a pretty good grasp of who Lisa Jaster was. What I didn't understand is why I was doing this. Of course, equality, we talk about that. I went to this school thinking, I'm gonna change the world. I'm gonna show the world that I can do some things that nobody ever expected me to be able to do. What I didn't realize was that wasn't my final goal. That wasn't my end state. So the first week of Ranger School is called Wrap Week. It's 4 days. I know, we call it Wrap Week. It's Army. The first day is a physical fitness test. Includes a 5-mile run, chin-ups, push-ups, sit-ups. 400 people showed up on day zero to report to my Ranger School class. Only 300 made it to breakfast. 101 people. Okay, so 299 made it to breakfast. 101 people failed that physical fitness test on the first day before breakfast even started. They had $2,000 worth of gear, plus whatever the Army issued them. They had all shaved their heads, including me. You like my haircut? Yeah, pretty nice, huh? I'm telling you, I got lots of attention for that one. 400 people showed up and had trained 4 months, some of them for years, and they didn't even make it to breakfast. That's crazy. So for 4 days, you are standing, running, jumping, climbing, obstacle courses, water survival tests, knife fighting classes. They were really dumb. It sounds a lot cooler than it really is. But on the last day, the last event is a 12-mile ruck march. And you have to do it at a really good pace. And the ruck's kind of heavy. But if you've served before, we've all done the 12-mile road march, or a lot of us have, and it's not that hard, unless you haven't slept in 4 days and you haven't eaten a whole lot. Then it's really hard. So I'm kind of tired during my road march. And I keep a laminated picture of my kids in my pocket, and it's got my daughter and son, and they're both wearing, she's wearing like a Wonder Woman shirt, and my son's wearing a Batman shirt. And I had laminated it and written on there, I need to be their superhero. And so I would pull that out every once in a while to remind myself to keep pushing. And I get to the point where I'm pretty far behind. I'm looking at my watch, I'm looking at the mile markers, and I think there is no way I can pass. First thing that goes through my head is, man, I have to do this for the next generation of women. Pretty noble. Then I'm like, I got to do this for my kids. And then about mile 10, man, I cut my hair for this shit. And literally, the only reason I crossed the finish line in under 3 hours was because I couldn't possibly go back to work with that haircut without the tab. But it was kind of interesting because you start getting real tired, and I was a little delirious probably. And each of the mile markers are marked with chem lights. So these little glow-in-the-dark sticks, it's still dark out, and they're stuck to water, a water point, so you can fill your canteens or stop, tie your shoes, whatever. But every mile is marked with these chem lights. Well, I decided those last couple miles, I'm going to run to each chem light. So I'm going to walk until I feel better, and then I'm just going to run until I get to the chem light. And then I'm going to walk, and then I'm going to run. And I did this like walk-run thing because I was going to finish in time. Well, I get about mile 11 and a half, and the chem light, I just can't seem to make it there. Like, I'm wondering, I got to be close to the finish line. Well, I would get close to the chem light, and then the chem light would move away. And then I got close to the chem light, and then I passed the chem light, and then I realized the chem light was attached to a person. So I had been chasing somebody who had been marked with a chem light because they had been a previous heat casualty, so the instructors wanted to make sure to watch him so that he didn't pass out during the workout or during the road march. Oddly enough, me running after him is the reason why he was moving so fast. We both got a really good time because we were both chasing each other. It was really funny, and I felt really bad for the guy. He ended up not making it even to the next day because he did become a heat casualty, and he blamed that on me because he said the reason why he pushed so hard is not only did he want to finish, but he couldn't be beaten by a woman. The really cool thing about it, though, is it's really hot, so they cut these 55-gallon drums in half, and they set them on stilts on their side, and they fill the ranger instructors fill them with big ice blocks and water. So when you're done with this, to lower your core body temperature, you're supposed to put your hands, your forearms in the water. I guess it's a way to really quickly cool your body down. So I'm about dying because I ran a lot faster than I should have. So not only do I put my arms in there, I also, please don't judge me, I put my head in there. It's really nasty. So I'm sitting there in the water with my forehead, or with my forehead and forearms in the water, and I'm trying to cool down. And then I hear in a really creepy voice, this guy who's right next to me with his hands in the water, he's like, "Hey, Jaster, I'm sorry." That's what he said. He whispered in my ear. Now, Ranger School students aren't supposed to be talking to each other. So this guy is leaning over and whispering in my ear, and I think it's creepy as hell. And he's just saying, "I'm sorry." And finally, I can't keep my cool anymore. I'm like, "Dude, what's up?" He's like, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all the things I ever said about you that you'll never hear and you'll never know. When I heard about women coming into the school, I thought, they don't belong here. And you just kicked my ass in a road march." And I thought, wow, I changed his opinion. And his name's King James. We ended up being really good friends. He and I actually went out the door together that day. I had my little meltdown in the air. But he's an SF medic. He's been a hard charger his whole military career, and he thought, I could never work with women. But his opinion quickly changed. And he asked me, he's like, "How can you do this? How can you be out here with us doing what you're doing? How come you're not falling behind? You know, in the real army, the women are already always in the rear and they've lost their gear and they can't hold their own stuff. And I said, man, I was built for this. You know, don't judge everyone. He goes, you know, my wife's pretty tough, but she couldn't do this. And I looked at him straight in the eyes and said, yeah, women like me wouldn't marry men like you.
This podcast is brought to you by Dropbox. Dropbox is a leading global collaboration platform that's transforming the way people and teams work together. As a strategic partner, Dropbox is working with Salesforce to reimagine the work experience, building new solutions that eliminate disruption and help teams collaborate across sales, service, marketing, commerce, and more. Learn more at Dropbox.com. Next time on Blazing Trails, we're deep diving into sustainability. We'll explore what the latest changes are, take a look at preserving our oceans with leading experts, and a whole lot more. Thank you for joining us on Blazing Trails. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and keep up with exclusive content from trailblazers around the world.